I'm sorry to miss 2 days. I know those of you know me know that I don't like to miss children easily. And particularly now for the penis and other machzor also, you're concerned about how you'll do, I suppose. But I'll try to make up. I hope to arrange a mutually convenient time to make up the time to be lost. But I don't say that I regret having to miss it. I don't apologize for it. I'll tell you what the Rav once said. I'm hollow with mitzvah just before Pesach. The Levi was ever Pesach. He got home. It was really just barely. The Levi was here first, so I was in Boston. He got home barely before Yom Tov, and everything in a state of considerable disarray. But speaking about it later, I mean, the comment was, "Kein Stab nicht alle Tag." And something of this, that I don't know to what extent you feel it, but something of this I think should be sensed. I don't mean the first 11 with that member of the family, but about the potato of a person like the mother's mother. Of course, I don't suppose that many here who knew her at all or knew of her, she was a rather retiring sort of person, and in general, of course, an older person, not given to thinking much around the yeshiva now. Even though I remember when I first came to yeshiva, she used to come with a group of five, six other elderly women. They used to have another building at this time. This building didn't exist. They used to meet across the hall from the Medrash, and they had meetings to try to raise a little bit of money. I mean, how much could they have raised? A fellow called me up on Monday from the New York Times. Somebody told him that she was very active in philanthropy and scholarships. So I suppose he meant scholarship. He told me she was a scholar. So I explained to him that somebody must have told him that she was active in raising money for scholarships. So he wanted to know whether she was a big philanthropist, so I told him, actually a big philanthropist, and she didn't have much money. So I tried to explain to him, of course, that Risha Kaf doesn't understand so readily, but I tried to explain to him that she was active in a great way, but in a small way, in raising funds. So they used to meet across the hall from the Medrash, and at night she used to bake the cakes for them, bring them in, and at night after she was finished, she used to come to the Medrash and bring in the cakes, you know, the shrine to the bach. But of course, this, let's say, was many years ago, and of late, I don't suppose that many even knew her appearance. But of course, at the Levi yesterday, I suppose you got some account. The trouble is, most of you don't understand Yiddish, or many of you, and I don't know to what extent you got a feeling for her personality. She was an immensely unusual woman, extremely unusual woman. I suppose you got some sense of this, I mean, simply in the various testimonials, so to speak, which were cited yesterday, of Chaim's evaluation of her. Which itself, I've heard from time to time, these varying versions. One of the versions went beyond what was cited yesterday. The Chaim said that had she been a boy and studied like a boy, Moltigiven, he said, this is the other version, said, Moltigiven pays the Moltigiven from you. Of course, in a certain sense, maybe you think it's an exaggeration. Maybe you think a lot of what you heard yesterday is an exaggeration. It's not, believe me. Apart from the question of formal knowledge, which was discussed yesterday somewhat, formative, remarkable, tremendous insight, and particularly was not simply a question of a sharp insight here or there. Well, there are people who can be very unstable, but nevertheless have brilliant scattered insight. The thing that was so typical of her was the stability and the massive underpinning. At any point at which you approached her, anything was discussed with her, there was the same fundamental sanity and grasp of the situation, which really penetrated. And it's really this that I think so distinguished her, apart from the question of formal knowledge, although the formal knowledge was for a man or for a woman was considerable. It was the sanity, really. I mean, you normally take a person of her type, the way in which externally I suppose she would have appeared to one. One would never have imagined the range and the complexity of the reactions made to the situation. To see a woman like this, that's an alter abitur from the old school, so to speak, and in a certain sense she was a person who was mechunech, really al birke, about the Kuzhner, who was, you know, probably unknown to you, but the person who himself has a reputation as one of the Dela Heroi, the last generation. He was not of the kind school, he was of the old type, but a man of a very, very strong reputation in this area. And the person from Mechunach al-Birka absorbed really all of his anhagis, and yet at the same time was able to make in a really remarkable manner, was able to make an adjustment, but was not really an adjustment to the modern world. It was more a question of being able to embrace it and to include it, subsume it somehow within her orbit, kind of making it part of her market rather than being absorbed into it. And she was able to retain really fully, and I think this is part of what Rav Arad meant when he spoke of her as being a figure who seemed to be above the given generation. She was able to retain fully all of the values which made Eastern European life so rich, and at the same time to be able to apply them within a radically different context. I don't mean only a different context here, I mean a different context in Europe. After all, the Warsaw in which she lived in the 20s was radically different from a religious point of view from the religion in which she'd been raised. Warsaw in the 20s was city which was rife with radicalism, tremendous anti-yeshiva feeling. The yeshiva bachim were looked upon very scornfully in Poland between the world wars. She mentioned to me, in fact, once, I remember she said she remembers that she was a girl in Kuzhinets, so the mothers would sit over the baby carriages, over the cribs, and looked fondly upon their children, so they would wish that they should become Gedolei Yisrael. When she was raising her own children, if she goes back for a decade and a half of the century, two decades. So then everyone would be over the child and wish to become a professor, chemist, doctor, a lawyer, and so on. But she was able to retain in every sense the values which were so deeply imbued within her, really, and yet to be able to apply these. I remember the first time, I had not known her that well for the first year that I had contact with her. I was a Ben Bais in Rabbi's house for a number of years, long before I had any dealings with her. I used to see her, but see, I don't need this, it's a meet the marginal, and so what? It occurred that this Nisha Maskelis. I remember once coming into her house at Anset, and before we were married, I come in and I nearly keeled over. I see she's sitting and reading a scarlet letter. I was. I was a statement. I mean, I hadn't known that she knew how to read English, let alone to read the Scarlet Letter. It's overwhelming. And I mentioned it subsequently to the Bar Mitzvah, you know, I overwhelmed. And I suppose he sensed that what lay behind the question was the impression that somehow this was about the demon. And so he began to give somewhat of a descriptive account of his mother, not only some of the things he mentioned yesterday, but also her extensive range of knowledge in other areas. I mean, she knew Shakespeare, Paul, she read Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Pushkin, I mean, all the major Russian authors. These are for her Pachim Tanim. These are things that, she knew it and she was interested in it. And I mean, I just give this one example of the fact that with really a total commitment and involvement in Yahadut, she was nevertheless able at the same time to maintain such a healthy-minded outlook. And this really is the key. I don't know, of course you don't know about him either, so you don't appreciate him. But this really is the key to what makes him such a Adam Gadol. It's not just Laulan. It's, I mean, although Laulan, of course, is the, you know, the basis. But it's the fact that, normally speaking, you see the people whose commitment to Torah is as strong as his. So usually it's combined with other elements of be a beetle of the world, with elements of morbidity, of self-righteousness, or what have you. And what makes the Baal really such a striking person is precisely the ability to combine this tremendously passionate commitment to Yahadus with such a healthy-minded outlook, such a balanced sanity, which is not, I don't mean a sort of 18th century sweet reasonableness. I mean a capacity for seeing things in perspective, which manifests itself in a tremendous tolerance. I don't mean tolerance that, you know, most people have. Most people are tolerant because they don't care too much one way or the other. It doesn't mean enough to them that they should want to fight over certain issues. And the fact that tolerance, religious tolerance, for instance, is prevalent in the modern world is not because people are more tolerant. It's because they are, religiously speaking, less committed. Somebody once said, about the 18th century religious thought, that no one was ready to die for deism, and no one was called upon to do so. It doesn't require that sort of commitment. But in this case, it's a tolerance which is not the result in the slightest of indifference, but rather even the result of breadth of vision. And he spoke about this a little bit yesterday, this capacity for the patient, the slow, students. He discussed this many times about this, but he feels this very tremendously. But there, he quoted me once, the Gemara Eilvan, a Freida, who had a Talmud, with whom he learned the particular halakha 400 times, till he understood it. And Rabban said, look, when he said Stami, he could have, same time, he could have had probably a sharp from Talmidim, and he could have made a Luim out of them and gone around boasting, was like, here's Talmidim. But he did. And what he quoted yesterday also, the Gemara of Daily Night Tachia. And for instance, you know, Rabban was very much involved for retarded children, very active. Maimonides Institute. As a matter of fact, he came to Chicago now and started a school there for retarded children. I mean, that's Kadekach, the interest in people who are disadvantaged. And this is something which, and I'd say it's a capacity for tolerating weakness. And you don't appreciate it fully unless you realize it's not a Briska trait. Briska is not the Tevai tolerant tradition, and I mean, this has been developed. It's not great, and it's due great part to the indicator. It's due great part to his mother. You know, the one hand, she was a person who was a hilus in Amesh Yakutish, who used his mavel. I mean, this summer I was in one day Shabbos, we were sitting at the table and somebody burst in, and one of the grandchildren, to say it from the country that she suffered a stroke. She used to get these minor strokes from time to time. So we ran over there right away, and after having suffered it, she insisted to Shumaitin that she would not sit down to eat without washing, so she insisted on Mamish dragging herself over to the sink to wash. And furthermore, she realized that the others wouldn't, so she wouldn't have eaten any, it didn't bother so much to eat them, but she realized nobody else would sit down to eat unless she did. But Dafki, she pushed her sister on schlepping herself over. But at the same time, a person who used to get angry if people spoke with deprecation, and Guyan, for instance, she insisted you have to recognize the accomplishments and attainment, and who was able to be a kanoi in the best sense of the term, not in what is unfortunately the general assumption that some are kanois is to be measured in quantitative terms. I mean, how many things you prescribe and how many people you intimidate and how many people you reject. But kanois in a qualitative sense, in the sense of intensity of one's own commitment and depth of one's feelings, the adis. And these were qualities which she had in a tremendously rich, rich manner. It's unfortunate, as I say, that not many of us could have seen this, because, I mean, I wouldn't say that there won't be another woman like her. These things are too rash to predict. But the chances of it happening in your lifetime and mine are so slim as to be almost non-existent. I mean, this particular set of conditions which produced a woman of this type, apart simply from her own strength of character, these are not likely to be repeated. And I think at least, I hope that you got yesterday some glimpse of what essentially she has been. I really hope that you do not misunderstand. Some of you probably think that, as I said yesterday, the nature of filial gemara is somehow exaggerations which spring from the sort of kibudei. This is not so. Quite the contrary, King Gozi said in Kippurim, there's Yesha Bashi Kaisa Bechon Kosov Khan. There were other aspects which could have been touched upon, and for lack of time, other things were not. I think it's important for us to have, at any time, a certain glimpse of what a great person is like. It's one of the things, unfortunately, which we lack, but you know, we get it secondhand, I suppose, to go to written sources to get it. But it's not the same as trying to see or seeing another Gadol close up. And sort of vision that one should have for what greatness of character is so important that even a fleeting glimpse, a momentary look at it, you get perhaps in such a time, can be a great import. So I hope that at least some sense of what she was really an Adam Gadol. I mean, use the term Adam in the generic sense, and I hope that at least some sense of this you felt and perhaps made some impact upon you. Quite apart from this, it's really a shame that you don't understand Yiddish, because, well, maybe I hope many of you do. I mean, apart from everything else, the account of his mother, as well as, I mean, many of the things that Baram says, particularly, and he has to put it full of Mishra Narav, many of them were invaluable in their own right. But, certainly, I mean, within this context, and given, of course, the whole emotional impact of the moment, it's a thing far more meaningful in context. All right, I just wanted to give you perhaps a brief, very unsystematic insight into the nature of this person, in the hope, as I say, that perhaps some spark of what she's been will filter down and perhaps catch fire. All right, to get back to the Gemara, I said a shiur this summer once, but somebody thought it was very funny. I mean, it wasn't. A question came up, la'alocha, and I quoted something. Question says, "Did I love thing which she is once." She had heard once from Rav's mother, the name of Rav Elbel. She had discussed them back and forth, and I thought the summit seemed very strange. It wasn't. I mean, she was a person, she had different views from Rav Elbel in many matters, and he recognized this, but he considered her a worthy protagonist. He thought it was a great challenge to him. But discuss matters with her, at his point of view, on certain issues. Now, listen, a couple of years ago, when the Rabbanim's third son of Bar Mitzvah, he quoted something at the time. He spoke, Apam Yilovi Ishi, Eli, why Levi, why at that time, the third son, the doctor more than the others, she thought that Yaakov would then become close to her. And said it troubled him sometime. Why? And he mentioned the shot that he heard from his mother. He repeated it, elaborated upon it, and then mentioned something when he found in the Cheskuni. But I could not say, of course, if she knew everything in Shal, she had a clear sense of what was correct. What was it? And this, in a way, is the first thing that an idea of Lalman, what is and what is not Lalman. I remember a number of years ago, she once commented to me, she spoke very disparagingly of a certain issue, I don't know if I mentioned the name, but she, why? So, she said, of course, maybe she generalized one case, but she said that the incest, a number of years ago, Sukkot, there was a hurricane, and a number of Sukkot collapsed. So a person, so then the yeshiva, a whole discussion developed as to whether the Sukkot were kosher or not. Why? Because the Mechitza, right? So she met somebody, the person got to talk to him. So she said, look, if I stay in a hurricane, can I raise a time foul? Even a house can collapse in a hurricane. So he said, look, that's like a shiloh, you know. So he considered maybe really the problem of the houses. And she said to me, I mean, to say that she knew all the sugya, probably not, but she understood that a person who has this kind of a question, that it's impossible you should be allowed to know. And she was right. She had an instinct for what is healthy and what is unhealthy in Launan, which type of questions are valid and which are not valid, and gave her a grasp, you see, for this reason, which extended far beyond the bounds of whatever of actual knowledge might have been. All right, let's get out of the Gemara. There's a Pesach, she's a very wonderful. I'll tell you something about it, so we'll get to it later on.
Well,
she said like this, the Medrash states of about told beforehand, I was in his house, I was Friday, I wasn't Bar Mitzvah proper, I shot it in the he told me that these rushes, old rushes, particularly for me, and I found out, she asked Maisa why, she said, Sela is the third son. Medrash says that they were born very close to one after the other. They were all short pregnancies, all premature, and born almost successively. So she said, look, when Reuben was born, so Leah took care of him. Medrash was there. When Shimon was born, so she took care of him. Sometimes it happened, Reuben and Shimon needed attention at the same time. She would hold Reuben on one arm and Shimon on the other one. Then, though, the lady was born, so to be honest, she didn't have to. So she said, Pam, but you love Ishayla. Before, I continued that Yaakov held aloof somewhat between the top of the children. But subsequently, that then it became this. Rabban implied it in the following sense. Rabban says that when his children were born, so his children also were born pretty much in rapid succession. One of them was born in the Sfot Tammuz, and the second one was born the following year, Chateyor, and the third one was Kedesh Nisan, the following year. So he also thought, who's going to go and be the top of the little children? And when they'll grow up, they'll be old enough to learn Gemara, so sit down with them and they'll begin to learn. So he didn't, he was not the top of that much. Even though it's not, actually, I mean, I was with the Yitzhak Nichus at that time, but Rabban Toss, he used to, in the Tapal, I mean, by the standards which prevail for most of the yeshivas, he was very metapal, very, very much. But he said, so he thought he would not be metapal so much. But then, so he saw the first shot, the second shot, and then when the third one came, and this was Ramesses, the third war of Yasin. So then saw that he had to, his wife also didn't have to be armed, so he had to be metapal and take care of it. Of course, what he went on to say was that circumstance had forced him into a course of action which in retrospect he realized was the correct one. And that for a person, of course in the modern conditions it's all certainly true, that for a person to be metapal, you know, the children, when they're young, more or less neglect them, and all that, so you have to wipe the care of them. And then subsequently, when the child is 10 years old, maybe it just sits down and starts learning with him. So naturally, it's like the Gemara Basra. The Gemara Basra says, before the days, you could have been Gamla. So they used to take, because they didn't have Chadorim and Sukkonim, the folks in Israel. But the father used to learn with them, this, whatever. Yeah, maybe they took a Rebbe when the child got older. But then naturally, they found they took a 16-year-old boy, though, and they took a Rebbe. Down there with him, he's Mavai, but Rabbi Yates, and he told him to go jump in the lake. So, the same manner was the child, if you wait till the child was that age and begin to try to learn with him, of course, it's too late. See, this is one of the reasons that there were so many defections in Rabbanish homes in Europe. If you take in Europe, I mean, Gdeli Yisrael, the great beginning, but children, they were not metapal with so much. In some cases, they didn't even bother later to learn with them that much. They were more involved in their own learning. But there were also cases where, let it go, let the rabbis take care of them, and so on. And later, when they began to become older, they then started to learn with them somewhat. But of course, by that time, the emotional rapport which the child is developing with father in the early years was no longer attainable. And this is one of the reasons that many, almost many, many daily in Europe, that children, I mean, in this century, it'll be years ago, so in this century, the children then turned out to be religious. There are not many rabbonim, people of this country, rabbonim who came, Tikhtar rabbonim, and Agudis rabbonim, 40, 50 years ago. There are not too many the children became b'nai teva. Not very many. And, of course, I'm not blaming them. In many cases, circumstances were difficult. But to a certain extent, it was because of this attitude of... Naturally, look, before there weren't so many other influences. But in this century, what happened was that other influences began to prevail, so you have to be metapal with children in order to bribe the counteract for this, and in many cases where this was not done, this is what happened. This is exactly why the Briska Maseira was strong, because this tradition of pounding away at the children is very, very strong. They all learn with their own children in varying degrees, and that's why they've been able to maintain themselves on a high level over a period of time. Anyways, he went on to develop this idea. He then spoke also a little bit about what he said yesterday, the question of a single parent having to fulfill a double function. Of course, yesterday he spoke about it in relation to actual yasmus, the one parent is no longer alive, but at that time he spoke about it in a more general context that there are certain aspects of motherhood within a father and certain aspects of fatherhood within a mother. In other words, there's a certain dominant personality, but at the same time, there has to be the father has to be in certain respects a mother's way. Quoted in Medrash, Mirosh Tzuli Merenu, Mikvoris Ashurenu, the Medrash says, Mirosh Tzuli Metegelu Avay, Mikvoris Ashurenu Elu Yimoy. And he said was, the father is sort of like to see himself as led as the child at the pinnacle of achievement. The father is ready at the top of the mountain, and he's ready to begin to soar, then that the father should join hands with him and to work with him, and naturally that's going to take, I suppose, the credit too. And this is the mid of Avais. And the boys are the slow climbing up the grace. I should add the slow climbing up the mountain, very painstaking, but which is not as glorious. And this was, but there are times, that's what he's then developed the idea, that the times when the father has to be, in effect, a mother